Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast, as always, Up to Speed with Formula One. My name is Mark Daly, and today is March 7th, 2024. Got a busy show for you coming up, but we're going to start off talking about, well, what else? Christian Horner and Red Bull, and the latest news in that continuing saga and scandal. Then in the second segment, we got Jonathan Clegg from the Wall Street Journal here to discuss his new book, The Formula. And then finally, in the third segment, we're going to talk about the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, which is going to go down this weekend. It's another Saturday night race in the Middle East, which means that here on the West Coast, it's going to go off at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. So a nice way to start the weekend, and personally, I kind of like it, especially after the season opener in Bahrain last weekend, to be all finished and done, mid-morning, and get the podcast out by lunchtime was certainly a treat, because I felt like I got my homework done as soon as I got home from school, and it left the rest of the weekend to do other weekendy things. And I make that sound like really negative, right? As if sitting down, having my breakfast, and watching a Grand Prix on a Saturday morning is just like doing the math homework or English homework or whatever it was that we all hated as kids growing up. Anyways, let's get into the Formula One news. And there's a news that came out earlier today that Red Bull has suspended the accuser in the Christian Horner scandal, the sexting scandal that has been ongoing for a number of weeks now. As far as I can tell, it sounds like the person in question was working at Red Bull up until about a week ago. And the team has not made any comments other than, quote, "We are unable to comment as it is an internal matter," end quote. So this story just keeps going and going and going. And there were some additional quotes and stories here. Let's just talk about there was a press conference on Thursday today. And Christian was asked a number of different things about the whole scandal about Max Verstappen, seeing out his contract at Red Bull. Also, some of the comments leveled at Christian Horner about the whole scandal and what he thought of that. There's a number of interesting quotes here. The first one, the reporter asked Christian about the suspension of the complainant in the matter and whether or not he was going to say anything more on it. And Horner had to say, quote, "Look, I'm afraid I can't comment on anything that's confidential between an employee and the company, so I can't offer you anything on that, I'm afraid," end quote. He was also asked if there was any plans by Red Bull to be more transparent on this entire case, and Christian deflected that as well, saying, quote, "I think it's a complicated issue because each company and these companies," pointing to the rest of the team principals in the Formula and paddock that were also in the press conference or the scrum, went on to say, "will be exactly the same as with any other major company, that there's a grievance process that takes place in any company. This process is confidential between the individuals and the company itself. I'm not at liberty, unfortunately, due to those confidentiality clauses, and out of respect to the company and, of course, the other party, that we're all bound by the same restrictions," end quote. So he was also asked about Jos Verstappen and the comments that that he made about him over last weekend. He was asked, about Jos's comments and what his whole purpose in doing so, that basically he made an ultimatum that it will either be Horner that has to leave Red Bull or Max that has to leave the team. And Christian had the following to say, quote, "Well, look, I'm obviously aware of the comments that were made. There was a discussion subsequent to the race, and I think everybody focuses focuses very much on the future. The team focuses very much on defending both of these world titles that we've fought so hard to achieve. Max has three successive world titles to build on that. The 55 victories that he's achieved, the 114 victories that as a team we've achieved, and now sit right with Williams on the amount of Grand Prix victories. So our focus is very much on the future. As I say, discussions that took place following the race in Bahrain, and we're all looking forward, end quote. And then he was also asked if there was any point or any plans to clear the air between himself and Jos Verstappen. And he basically, again, said that that he wasn't going to discuss things that were talked about in private. And he wasn't going to elaborate any further on that. So there we go. not a lot that was really divulged in that. I don't think it's really a... you know, a surprise. I mean, he was also asked if he felt that there was a, you know, a conspiracy or a campaign that was going on against him behind the scenes, and if he had any ideas or any theories as who that might be, or if he wanted to basically come out and say that. Christian had to say, quote, look, we've been tremendously successful. We've done a lot of winning, and we're very united as a team, and that's what we're focused on for the future. There's obviously been an awful lot of coverage around the situation, but I think the time is really now to move on, to focus on what's going on at the track, and we've got a busy and competitive season ahead of us, and that's what we're certainly focused on, end quote. So he certainly did not want to address that question poised to him by a reporter, and it is a very, very strange situation, isn't it? And certainly I just can't help but feel that. And again, this is going to be speculation on my own behalf, that I don't believe that there was any cover-up by Red Bull. I think that they tried to do what they needed to do by appointing an independent investigator to come in, take a look at the allegations, because if you take it at sort of face value, and that's not to say that there was something going on, but they feel like that they've done a good job to investigate the allegations properly. But what would be the point in Red Bull covering up the situation? I mean, if they... yeah, well, obviously there is a lot to lose if they, you know, if we're come to light, but I would feel that the repercussions that would be even greater if it came out that Christian did all the things that he was alleged to do and Red Bull knew about it and they covered it up, not to mention the ethics involved with the independent investigator that came in. You know, that's an independent lawyer, an independent barrister. They are bound by their own professional code of ethics. And I couldn't see this being swept under by the rug. I mean, that person's reputation and likely that of their own firm would be forever smeared and, you know, dragged through the mud, and rightfully so if they were in breach of their own professional standards and conducts. But Red Bull certainly have equally as much, if not more, to lose. I mean, we talked about on the podcast a couple of weeks ago how Tim Farley, CEO of Ford, wanted some more transparency or information from Red Bull because they wanted to make sure that everything that was going on was in alignment with Ford's corporate values and everything that that they hold important as an organization. And, you know, that's a major, major partnership that they have with Ford. And I couldn't help but wonder if this came out, even in the best possible circumstances, would just be, you know, full and complete transparency of everything that happened, and say it did happen to be as bad as it is, or was alleged, pardon me. But if it were to come out that everything happened that was alleged and then it was covered up on top of it, that would just be disastrous for them. I mean, who knows what sort of penalties could be levied against them by the governing body, by Formula One. Who knows if there'd be any sort of recourse there. I mean, they would certainly potentially lose a lot of money in sponsorship. I mean, it could damage that relationship with Ford. It might force them to reconsider that their partnership with Red Bull. So I don't know. I mean, I always just try to, you know, apply some simple logic to the situation and just accept that the simplest explanation is probably most likely the truth. And I don't know. I mean, like I say, I feel like that there's way too much to lose to if they were to do the very underhanded thing and try and cover it up, and then the all the negative repercussions that could really literally rock that that team to its core if it ever came to light. So anyway, so let's take a look here. There was also a couple of other quotes from Max Verstappen. So he did defend his father, Jos. He was talking to the Daily Mail. Jos Verstappen originally said, quote, "There's tension here while he remains in the position. The team is in danger of being torn apart. It can't go on the way it is. It will explode. He is playing the victim when he is the one causing the problems." So this went on for 8 weeks, which seems ridiculous. It is ridiculous, but I can't believe that amount of time actually transpired that, for this whole situation to, I wouldn't say conclude itself. I feel like it's going to go on for some time. But Max Verstappen went, he didn't go on to really support or back what his father said in public, at least as far as I can tell. But he hasn't really walked away and distanced himself from Jos's comments. He was asked if he was, if his dad maybe wanted to walk back what he said, or if he maybe had some regrets, for saying what he did about Horner and the fact that the team might explode if he doesn't leave. Max said, quote, "I haven't asked him that. I think I know him, of course, from when I was already in go-karting. He was always very outspoken. He's not a liar, that's for sure." Then he was also he said he didn't want to take sides in the matter. But he said that he didn't feel like it was very unusual or strange if there was differences and different opinions within the team or just organizations in general. Max went on to say, quote, "I think everyone in general, even if you have arguments or not, there are always things that can be worked out in general. I think everyone is man enough and respectful enough to each other anyway in that sense. I don't always agree with everything that happened, just in general in F1, and that's why sometimes it is good to have a discussion about things. You might agree to disagree sometimes. That's also happening in a relationship," end quote. He also just went on to talk quickly about the relationship that he has with his dad. He said, quote, "My dad and I, we are very close. We call every day, even if he's not around or whatever. But on the other hand, also, I'm not the guy who likes to speak a lot about certain stuff. I just want to focus on the driving bit. And if there are any issues, we try to resolve them within the team," end quote. So sounds like, at least from that little quotation there, that Max very much trying to walk the middle ground and, not try and damage, his relationship with either his dad, Jos, or with the team itself. Verstappen feels that that he doesn't have any reasons to leave the team, to leave Red Bull Racing. Christian Horner feels that that Max himself is going to stay. He's got a contract with the team now until 2028. And Max says that he doesn't feel like he has to leave the team, despite the concerns that Jos has with team principal Christian Horner. Max was asked about his contract that is going to run until 2028. Max said, quote, "That has, of course, always been the intention of signing. That's why we signed so long to be here. And of course, it's about the performance of the car. And from 2026 onwards, that is quite a bit of a question mark with the new regulations. But I knew that when I signed my contract. I also know what they have done for me in my career, right? So yeah, the intention is, of course, absolutely to stay with this team because I really enjoy it. And I'm also really happy within the team. So as long as we perform, there is no reason to leave." Anyways, I think that this is very much a situation of stay tuned and see what happens, because I don't think it is necessarily over at all. And I feel like we're going to be talking about this for some time to come. And I just can't help but wonder whether or not more information will come out, whether or not something gets leaked one way or another. Anyways, we will wait and see. Also, just really wanted to talk about FIA President Mohamed Ben Sulayem, who's been in the news this week. He's been had some allegations leveled against him that there was an accusation that he tried to get a penalty in last year's Saudi Arabian Grand Prix overturned when Fernando Alonso was reprimanded for Aston Martin prematurely touching his car during a pit stop. And this happened when he was already serving a 5-second penalty for lining up incorrectly at the race start. The team successfully protested the penalty, and Alonso was reinstated to third position at the end of the race. So that was one of his podiums in that run of podiums he had at the first third of the season or thereabouts. Anyways, it is alleged that Ben Sulayem called FIA president for the sport in the Middle East and North Africa, Sheikh Abdullah bin Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa, and made it quite plain that he felt that the penalty should be revoked. And then there's a second accusation that Mohammed bin Sulayem allegedly put pressure on officials not to certify the Las Vegas Grand Prix street circuit ahead of the Grand Prix that went ahead last November, and that's a sort of an interesting one because I want to say it was a successful Grand Prix, but I'm not entirely convinced anymore because it seems the more and more I talk to people, the people I talked to initially after that race was run last November it was successful, people enjoyed it, and now I seem to run into more people on the flip side that didn't enjoy it as much. So anyways, that's a little bit different matter. Anyhow, the FIA issued a statement regarding that matter saying, quote, the FIA confirms that the compliance officer has received a report detailing potential allegations involving certain members of its governing bodies. The compliance department is assessing these concerns, as is common practice in these matters, to ensure that due process is meticulously followed, end quote. So there you go. Lots of news and lots of machinations and things like that going on in the background. And we'll certainly have to wait and see what happens with Mohammed bin Sulayem and also with the ongoing Christian Horner saga over the time that's in the time ahead. Anyways, I'm going to pause a little bit quickly or a little bit earlier here than usual for a quick message from our sponsors. Up next, we have Wall Street Journal sports editor Jonathan Clegg on deck, who is here to discuss his latest book, The Formula, How Rogues, Geniuses, and Speed Freaks Re-Engineered F1 into the World's Fastest Growing Sport. Please don't go away. I'll be right back. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. All right, joining me today to talk about his new book, The Formula, How Rogues, Geniuses, and Speed Freaks Re-Engineered F1 into the World's Fastest Growing Sport, is the Wall Street Journal sports editor Jonathan Clegg. Jonathan is a graduate of the London School of Economics and previously held several other important roles at the journal, including senior editor on their digital platforms team, reporter and editor on the sports desk, and he was also the journal's first European-based reporter. The Formula is the latest of his three books that he has co-authored with Wall Street Journal colleague Joshua Robinson. Jonathan Clegg, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
First of all, love the book. I got my copy last week, spent the weekend going through it, and very nicely written, and just a real pleasure to read.
Thank you. Thank you. That means a lot.
Well, I just want to jump right into it. And the first question I have for you is, I feel like we have a little bit of a common background here, maybe not as I haven't obviously ever worked for the Wall Street Journal, but I spent nearly a decade covering Major League Soccer for various platforms and outlets here in, on the West Coast. But I'm very interested in your story, because the other two books that you've co-authored with Josh, The Club, How the English Premier League Became the Wildest, Richest, Most Disruptive disruptive force in sports. Great title. And then Messi versus Ronaldo, one rivalry, two goats, and the era that changed the world's game. So taking all of that into account, these other two books that you've previously written, why was now a good time to diverge and go into Formula One?
Well, I think it's mostly to do with the fact that Formula One has sort of now occupies the same sort of space, I feel like, in the American sports landscape that the English Premier League did, you know, when I first moved here. So I think I moved from London to New York in 2012. And I feel like it was right around that time that the Premier League, the profile of the Premier League in this country really exploded and started to match the same sort of popularity that English soccer has around the rest of the world. And it was that was sort of the impetus behind writing our first book, The Club, which was about essentially about the Premier League's, the explosion of the Premier League and becoming the sort of global entertainment monster that it is today. And I think around about, you know, a couple of years ago, we sort of started to sort of realize that what was happening to F1 was really analogous to what was happening to the Premier League a decade earlier. It was around that time that we started to see, you know, stories about Drive to Survive in like every major news outlet. The New Yorker wrote about F1. It just sort of felt that suddenly this sport that had, you know, much like English soccer, had sort of previously been a kind of niche, you know, sport as far as the American kind of sports public was concerned, was starting to level up, has sort of climbed up to a different sort of stratosphere. And we actually sort of envisioned the book as a sort of partner book to the club, because they both sort of essentially unpack similar stories of how, essentially a kind of European sport, took over the world.
You know, John, what I really liked about the book is it covers such a wide range of eras in Formula One, going back to the late 50s, early 60s, 70s, 80s, and even as recently, well, modern times. And there's a, you know, entire chapter devoted to Abu Dhabi in 2021. I was just wondering, in covering or researching and interviewing so many different people, and there's so many different personalities included in the book, including Bernie Ecclestone, Colin Chapman, Enzo Ferrari, Ron Dennis, Lewis Hamilton, and more. I was just wondering, when you have such a broad and diverse cross-section of people, were there any common traits or, you know, recurrent themes that that you and Josh noticed when writing the book?
Well, yeah. So I think the big one, the one that really kind of animated the entire book was, you know, I think when we approached the project, we sort of knew that we wanted to tell a deeper story than just F1 was bought by Liberty Media and they promoted it aggressively in the States. And then it became very popular in the US. That was a very sort of simplistic story that like a lot of people had written about Drive to Survive. And we sort of felt that actually what was happening was something that could be traced back much further. And I think that thing, that sort of one thing that animates essentially the entire history of F1 as we've kind of constructed it in this book was the sport's sort of appetite for and thirst for reinvention. Just how often this sport, the teams in this sport, the individuals in this sport have kind of reinvented one aspect as a way to sort of get ahead, to take a step ahead of the pack, is the one thing that sort of, the one through line that sort of runs right from the very beginning to Colin Chapman and, you know, the sort of crazy, you know, aerodynamics and ground effects stuff that he was working on back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, all the way through, you know, the McLaren era of Ron Dennis, the Williams era, you know, the Williams era in the early 1990s, Ferrari under, you know, Ross Brawn and Michael Schumacher, you know, right the way through to Bernie Ecclestone himself in the way that he envisioned the sport and packaged the sport as an entertainment product, as a TV product. It's really a story of reinvention. And I think, you know, one of the things when you look at Formula One and where it is today, perhaps the biggest surprise is that it's now in the current time that Formula One has sort of ridden this wave of popularity, because by all rights, Formula One doesn't feel like a sport that should be suddenly popular right now, right? In the world that we live in right now with climate change, a worry for a large number of people, it doesn't feel like a sport built around the combustion engine should be, you know, so popular. But it is. And I think a lot of that is to do with the fact that Formula One has sort of so successfully reinvented itself so many times. It's sort of like almost a sort of necessity that you have to sort of reinvent yourself, readapt to survive. And that has actually underpinned Formula One's success pretty much since the word go.
Yeah, I thought that was a very good point. And I think that it's made early on in the book that Formula One completely or basically reinvents itself every couple of years from the ground up, unlike almost any other sport on the face of the planet. And one of the things I really enjoyed reading the book and my experience was that I felt that each story, because each chapter is almost a little story of itself, like the storylines kind of weave its way through, but you don't necessarily have to start at the beginning or the end, but you very well could kind of read it a la carte if you wanted to. But what I really enjoyed is just how vivid each story was. And it didn't really matter if it was going back to the stories of the early days of Lotus with Colin Chapman in the early 60s or Toto's recollections of the debacle that was Abu Dhabi 2021. I really felt at some points that I was a fly on the wall. I felt that I was reliving the history that was happening. And I thought it was really cleverly done, and I was wondering, well, how did these guys do it? And then, so I got to the end of the book, and then I started to read the acknowledgments, and then I saw, well, you spent time with, sitting down with Bernie Ecclestone and his wife, and Total Wolf, Christian Horner, Luca de Montezemolo, and more. I mean, the list is, expansive. So that must have been quite an experience in of itself, was to sit down with so many of these key players that have had such a profound experience. I mean, I'd love to sit down with Bernie Ecclestone and just, not that I'm a match on any level with him, but to sit there and just to hear him recount some of those stories the decades of his involvement in F1 must have been really, something unique.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, and as someone who has covered soccer, I think you'll appreciate that. I think the biggest difference we found writing this book compared with the other two books that we've written is that the level of access that we were given in Formula One far, far outstripped. It is a real challenge to get people involved in professional soccer to sit down with you and chat. And we felt that Formula One, it was the opposite. They really threw open their doors. Pretty much everyone that we wanted to speak to for this book gave us the time to speak to them, which I think is, both a reflection of the fact that, the sort of popularity that Formula One is experiencing right now is a relatively new phenomenon. So they haven't become sort of like inured to it in the same way that like professional soccer players have, where they sort of take the publicity for granted and assume that it's never going to go away. I think Formula One is still a little bit in a kind of pinch yourself moment about the success that it's had in the last sort of half decade. And appreciates that it needs to work hard to sort of maintain that level of success and popularity. And then I just think it sort of also speaks a little bit to the personalities of the people involved and just their appetite to speak to us. What you said about the book is exactly how we approached it. I think we sort of thought, at first about the sort of individual characters and episodes that we wanted to blow out and focus on during the course of the book. And then, within that, we tried to find the sort of narrative arcs that link these two together. So you can read the McLaren sort of chapter about Ron Dennis and Ayrton Senna, and that will sort of stand as a standalone story. But when you sort of stack it up with the other stories from the history of F1, Chapman, Frank Williams, Brawn and Ferrari and Horner and Red Bull and all these guys, then you start to see that it's the themes that sort of run across the whole sport and the sort of the thing that unites the sort of most successful people in Formula One, being this sort of willingness to zag when everyone else is zigging one way, or to take a risk. All of these guys invariably took huge risks to get where they were. And it's that appetite for risk, that appetite for reinvention and adaptation that really sort of unites all these guys. And even though they're, individual sort of reinventions or revolutions within the sport could be incredibly different, when you think about sort of Ron Dennis's, the sort of professionalism and corporate veneer that he sort of lent McLaren during his time. You know, very, very different from the sort of things that Ross Brawn was doing to elevate Ferrari, you know, which was much more about, you know, working with Bridgestone and really sort of like weaponizing the tire as the sort of secret weapon of the Ferrari dynasty that he built with Michael Schumacher. You know, there's really very, very different. One is a sort of engineering problem. One is, you know, a sort of professionalism and approach to sort of marketing and branding that Ron Dennis kind of, you know, invented essentially back then. But so even though those two things are very different, when you sort of begin to see them in that context of reinvention, it kind of makes sense. And the stories kind of then knit together and you begin to see the sort of broader themes that have really animated the sport.
Yeah, and I think the book was a nice compliment to others that I've read. I mean, you know, Ross Brawn's book, Total Competition, which has been out for a number of years, was a fascinating read. And I always thought it was interesting how he basically said that he approached every project as basically a 3-year project, 1 year to see what was going on, the second year was to implement change, and, you know, year 3 basically to get on with it and you know, win races. But yeah, it was also interesting, too, the whole chapter, you know, first of all, the lap of the gods and that whole sort of 80s era of McLaren and Ron Dennis bringing that team to where it was. And, you know, really, I thought I mean, we all thought it was bad between Nico Rosberg and Lewis Hamilton several years ago, but that was nothing compared to Ayrton Senna and Alan Prost back in the late 80s. But, you know, it was interesting, too. We were just mentioning just like how professional that, you know, and the image that Ron Dennis wanted to project, that the offices needed to be painted gray because that, in his opinion, was a professional color, because, you know, if you wore a professional suit, it was gray. And just, you know, how down to the finest detail, how precise he was and things like that. And then, you know, I just couldn't reconcile that part of McLaren to Mike Coughlin's wife walking into a copy shop in Clapham or wherever it was with, you know, several hundred pages of technical documents from Ferrari, and basically how that almost brought the entire house of cards tumbling down. And, you know, I know that's what, over a dozen years ago now, but I can't help but wonder that, and you know, I've speculated about this before, that, you know, that massive fine that was unprecedented in sports history was, you know, still affects McLaren to this day. I mean, just, you know, it's, and I guess you could, yeah, please,
yeah,
go ahead.
No, it's crazy. I agree. I think, you know, I think if you, the Ron Dennis era didn't end when the Spygate judgment came down, but I think that really did mark the sort of end of McLaren as, you know, the sort of front runner that it had been for so long. And I think, you know, one of the craziest things that we found out during the writing of this book was, which I guess, you know, many people may have already put together, but it didn't occur to us until we were writing this book, that the Spygate judgment on McLaren was delivered on the exact same day that the New England Patriots were punished for their version of Spygate in the NFL. And the Patriots got away with a $500,000 fine, and McLaren was fined $100 million, which just, you know, shows to you the massive extent of difference between these two teams who were sort of both found to be cheating, but you know, just how draconian that punishment was for McLaren. And I think you're right. I think for Ron Dennis, you know, oddly, I think the sort of shame of being found guilty of cheating when he had spent, you know, his entire life essentially building McLaren into the absolute model, professional operation. And the fact that it was his team that was discovered to have been breaking the rules was almost more painful for him than having to cut a check for $100 million to the FIA, because it went against everything that he had stood for, which was, you know, McLaren's, you know, complete, you know, professionalism and its sort of corporate image being, you know, absolutely A-class. So yeah, I think you're completely right that it is incredibly ironic that the Ron Dennis era ended with such a sort of, you know, with something that tarnished his legacy, you know, tarnished the legacy of McLaren so much, because image was his invention in F1, that idea that an F1 team was as much a sort of marketing and branding operation as it was a race outfit, was really the one sort of concept that led to the success that McLaren had for so long. And it really is incredible to look back at how dominant McLaren was for so many of those years when Ron Dennis first took over, right at the beginning of the 80s, all the way through until, the very late 90s with Mika Hakkinen. McLaren's record is sort of unmatched still to this day. I mean, you have to get to the sort of modern day Red Bull and Mercedes dynasties to find something that equates with what McLaren was doing back then.
You know, it's also interesting, too, because, you talk quite a bit in the book about Spygate and Crashgate. And I think it's kind of interesting, too, because, you know, as we sit down to record this whole situation with Christian Horner continues to unfold. But, you know, these political machinations and, you know, skullduggery and shenanigans, it's nothing new to Formula One. I mean, I thought that there were many great quotes in this book, but there was one in the Piranha Club, the chapter that I absolutely loved, and I think I'm going to print this out and put this up somewhere. So Flavio Briatore had to say, you know, regarding Crashgate, quote, "Our drivers are or have been world champions." And then you have a driver who almost retired, Rubens Barrichello, and another who is a concrete post, Jenson Button, fighting for the championship. I don't know how we can say we have credibility. I thought that last sentence was just like, am I I can't be the only person in the room that sees the irony in this statement. I thought that was just kind of summed it all up. So, I mean, as we deal with this, unfolding situation with Red Bull and Christian Horner, these scandals really aren't anything new. Perhaps the magnitude of this current one is a little bit bigger than we've seen in the past, but, you know, it's just incredible.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the reasons that, success never lasts for long in Formula One is because, you know, as we said at the beginning, this is a sport that basically reinvents itself every few years. And technologically and technically and, you know, from an engineering perspective, the sport transforms very quickly as well. But the other main reason is because everyone involved in it is so incredibly vicious and all out to get each other. And so you can't survive on top for very long because they will find a way to bring you down. And so even though this Christian Horner situation, you know, yes, it probably is the biggest scandal that the major F1 team principal has encountered since Spygate and Crashgate. The difference being, of course, this isn't a matter of sporting integrity necessarily.
True.
This isn't about the race on the track and something being done there. Now, obviously, what Christian Horner is alleged to have done, and, that still affects the Red Bull sort of workplace. So it is not completely divorced from the success of the F1 team. But regardless, it doesn't matter that it's not a matter of sporting integrity. The rest of the F1 paddock has sort of found a way to sort of we'll find a way to kind of undermine or undercut Christian Horner's position or use this against him such that even now it sort of feels like his future is very much on a knife edge. And like you say, that a lot of that, you know, is down to the fact that this is, you know, they don't call it the Piranha Club thing is not a joke. These are people who will tear you down the first opportunity they get.
and we'll see where this one goes, because what the situation this morning with Christian Horner might not be the same this afternoon or tomorrow.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to move on because there was a lot of great quotes in the book, but there was one statement in the chapter, The Prancing Horse, which really stood out to me. And I think it's a recurrent, it could almost be an evergreen statement about the team. So specifically, you and Josh write, quote, "It would be fair to assume that this team must be the greatest, most successful sporting organization ever to exist. The Yankees, Lakers, Real Madrid all roll into one, sweeping up championship season after season. Only the reality for this company, which spends the bulk of its time selling its own history, is that most of its years in Formula One aren't remembering at all." I thought that was absolutely brilliant. And, you know, could you maybe unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, this speaks a lot to the incredible success that Ferrari has had, not just as an F1 team, obviously, but as an automotive giant, which is there is probably no car company in the world, and in fact, very few companies, period, whose branding and marketing is as strong as Ferrari's. And remember, they achieved this without actually advertising on television. The fact that the kind of archetypal sports car, when you picture it in your mind, is red like a Ferrari. You know, the fact that the Ferrari has sort of become the absolute epitome of, you know, sports car design is a complete triumph that can be traced right back to the very beginning of the company, of the, you know, car manufacturing, side of things. And yeah, it's F1 history, or it's F1, you know, history all feeds into this idea of that Ferrari is the sort of ultimate dream machine luxury package. You know, it's when you think about what Ferrari stands for, it's luxury, it's exclusivity, all these things they have worked hard to maintain. I think, you know, we recount the story that when Luca de Montezemolo took over Ferrari, the car manufacturing side of things, he immediately cut the number of Ferraris that they were producing, right? He wanted the wait list to grow longer because the wait list for a Ferrari needs to be long to sort of enhance this idea that these are very sought after things, that it's hard to get your hands on. And so much of Ferrari is all about that. It's myth making. These guys are the best myth makers of anyone involved in the car industry. And a lot of their F1 history, when you look at it, is not great. And yet when people think about Formula One, Ferrari and Formula One are completely synonymous. You get many times during the course of the book, different people express this exact same sentiment. Bernie Eccleston and Luca de Montezemolo, you know, Ross Brawn, that Formula One and Ferrari are completely synonymous, that you almost couldn't have Formula One without Ferrari. And yet, when you look at the history books, Ferrari hasn't actually been as successful as many other teams who are sort of less synonymous with Formula One. It's sort of something that's very difficult to square until you recognize that Ferrari, this is what Ferrari does. They are in the business of, cultivating this image of, success, luxury, extravagance, exclusivity. And that goes right down to their own Formula One history.
It's interesting too, because when you talk about things like how, the elegance, the exclusivity of Ferrari, and the, the interesting character that was Enzo Ferrari. And, I just kind of remember as a kid, the pictures of this white haired old Italian guy with the dark sunglasses. And just, I thought it was interesting some of the stories in the book that in private, he was like, quite this boorish character. And then I was also, it blew my mind in the chapter by Michael Schumacher, how he had Enzo's old office at Fiorano turned into his, into his little retreat or whatever,
right.
Whatever you want to call that. That was, such a mind blower as well. But I just wanted to, go over one thing, which I think is maybe kind of a nice capstone and kind of tie everything back into it, because we started off talking about this era of Drive to Survive and how Formula One has really percolated up through the sporting consciousness here in North America, specifically in America over the past several years. But there was one statement in the epilogue of the book, and I thought it was interesting because the guy that that you reference actually plays a fairly small part, at least directly, in Drive to Survive, and that's Max Verstappen, because he's kind of had a on again hot and cold relationship. And the quote is, "By all rights, Verstappen should be the face of F1's Drive to Survive era." What was the thought behind that that statement?
Well, just that he's been the sort of most successful driver for most of the Drive to Survive era, and B, in the sense that Drive to Survive has really sort of connected Formula One with this much younger, more sort of diverse, less almost more sort of casual fan base. It's very strange that Max Verstappen isn't the sort of poster child for that period. This is a guy who, by all rights, should be connecting with the sports new fans on social media, because he's young and plugged into this entire world. It's ironic that Daniel Ricciardo should be sort of much more plugged into that kind of world than he is, when Max is the one, let's be honest, who's out there winning races every weekend. Mm-hmm. So but I think again that speaks to something about Max's character, which he is, whichever way you slice it, he is this sort of like natural born racer. And I think the other parts of F1, the parts that Even the parts that sort of Lewis Hamilton embraced in terms of like the, you know, what it can do to his public profile and the you know, his relationship with high fashion and celebrity. And, you know, I feel like it certainly seems like, and, you know, we spent time with Max over the course of an entire race weekend in Suzuka. He just seems genuinely not really interested in that world. He's all about, you know, being inside the cockpit and racing. And then when he's done racing at the track, he goes back to his apartment in Monaco and climbs into his simulator and does more racing, you know, virtual racing against people online, because that is, you know, what he lives for. He lives to race. And I think that is a sort of, it means that his sort of relationship with Drive to Survive has been, you know, a sort of difficult kind of prickly one at times, because he's just sort of not really interested in what they can offer him. You know, he doesn't really need them in the way that they need him.
Yeah, it's funny, and I know there's a big difference between professional footballers and Formula One drivers, but I noticed in my time working with you know, these upper level you know, elite level footballers, is that when it comes to media stuff, they're either good at it and they like it, they're good at it and they're terrible, or they like it, they're not good at it, or they're not good at it and they want to do it but they just don't come across. And then there's the group that kind of fall into the Marshawn Lynch school of thought of that I'm only here so I don't get fined. But, you know, Max, I kind of feel, is like one of those guys that he's there because he needs to be. Because it's funny, you see him in the interviews, and I find it interesting when you see some of these promo videos that Red Bull put out, or some of these archival bits. Like, there was this shooting day they had at Christian Horner's estates in the most recent series, and you see Max, you know, sort of, you know, relaxed and kind of in his element with, you know, with other people there. He seems completely different to the Max Verstappen that's got the, you know, the team shirt on, the team hat on, behind the microphone answering questions about, you know, the, you know, his pole position or his most recent win and things like that. So
yeah,
he is a
I think that's right. I think, you know, when you sort of look at how people into how the cast of Formula One interacts with Drive to Survive, they basically have three sort of, you know, motivating factors for getting involved, right? There are those people who like the attention of Drive to Survive, and I'm sure you know who those people are. There are the guys there are the guys who use it as you know, a way to sort of like plant some sort of psychological, you know, seed, or advance some sort of way of thinking to sort of denigrate an opponent, or, you know, sort of use it for the sort of mind games element. And then there's like Max, who feels like he's just fulfilling an obligation, and that's it. You know, like he's there because he has to be there, and he'll be there for the exact, you know, 22 minutes or whatever it is that he's supposed to be there. And as soon as that's done, he sort of, you can almost hear him let out a sigh of relief and carry on to do, you know, going to do whatever's next. But, but that's sort of how it feels like to me anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, having you know, been in a similar types of situations, I recognize a fellow that's, you know, heart isn't completely into it when I see it. Well, John, thank you so much for joining me today to tell me more about the formula, how rogues, geniuses, and speed freaks re-engineered F1 into the world's fastest growing sport. I know I've taken up a lot of your time this afternoon, but I just wanted to know before I let you go, is there any new projects in the works?
Not right now. We've been on a kind of 2.5 year cycle with these books. So, usually by the time one comes out, we're sort of starting to turn our attention to, what's next. So, you know, hopefully within the next, few months, you'll hear news from us about our next project. But right now we're just focused on getting this one out into the world, on March 12th.
Well, that's great. Of course, if anybody wants to get a copy of the book, and I highly recommend that you do, you can find it everywhere, including Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, or wherever good books are sold. John, thanks again for joining me. And you know, you hinted at it there, you know, there might be a new something coming down the line. And if people want to follow and kind of keep up with your latest news, how can they connect with you on social media?
Yes, I'm on Twitter, X, whatever it's called now, at Clegg John, CLEGGJON. And my co-author, Josh Robinson, is at Josh Robinson 23.
John, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Once again, that was Jonathan Clegg, co-author of the new book, The Formula. Time now for a quick break for a message from our sponsor. So please don't go away. We'll be right back.
Ocean.
All right, welcome back to the show. I certainly hope that you enjoyed that interview with Jonathan Clegg in the previous segment, and he has kindly left a copy of the book behind to give away to one of the listeners here. So if you would like a copy of The Formula, head on over to X, give me a follow, and I will put a post up there. And I'd like for all of you that are interested in winning a copy of this book, and like I say, I have one copy only, in the comment to that post, leave me your reason for who you believe is the biggest speed freak or rogue or genius in Formula One and the impact that they had on the sport. And also let me know when I pick a winner, please be in North America, because the shipping to get it outside and overseas is just exorbitant. So residents of North America, please, answer that question, and I will pick the best comment, and then I'll be in touch to get a copy of the book. And we'll let that contest run for a week. We'll let that run until the middle of the month, to the 15th. So beware the Ides of March. But in this case, this will be a positive one, because I will give away a copy of The Formula. Anyways, let's talk now about the upcoming Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. As I sit here on a Thursday evening at 9 p.m. here on the West Coast, we already have a couple of practice sessions under our belt. FP3 is set to go in about 8.5 hours, which is about 5:30 a.m. here on the West Coast. A little bit early to get up, even for a work day on a Friday morning. But as I said off the top of the show, the good thing is that it will be an 8 p.m. local start in Jeddah on Saturday evening, which means here on the West Coast will be a 9 a.m. start, and can sit down with my coffee and my breakfast and enjoy the race at a nice early time. But let's go back and let's take a look and see what happened last year. We had in qualifying at the end of Q3, we had Sergio Perez and Charles Leclerc for Ferrari lining up on row one. Row two, we had Fernando Alonso and George Russell. Row three, we had Carlos Sainz and Lance Stroll. Row four was Esteban Ocon and Lewis Hamilton. Row five was Oscar Piastri in the McLaren and Pierre Gasly in the Alpine. So Perez's fastest Q3 time was a 128.26. Leclerc's second fastest time last year was a 128.420, and Fernando's Q3 time, let's take a look, that was a 128.730. So you might be wondering, where the heck is Max Verstappen? Max qualified all the way down in P15 with a suspected drive shaft issue. His fastest time in Q1 was a 128.761, so fairly congruent with on par with everything else that was happening during the qualifying session, until his issues took hold. Obviously, when we get to the Q3 time of Sergio Perez, he was about half a second faster, track evolution and all that. But Max's fastest time in Q2 was a 149.953. So that obviously indicated that Max had quite an issue. So if we go back and then look at the final race qualification last year, we had Sergio Perez winning, Max Verstappen recovering nicely to get to P2. So we had an all Red Bull. Well, it's not a front row, but we had Red Bulls on P1 and P2. Third step of the podium was Fernando Alonso. We had George Russell, Lewis Hamilton in P4 and 5, respectively, for the two Mercedes cars. Carlos Sainz and Charles Leclerc, 6 and 7, respectively, for Ferrari. And then P8 and 9, there's a pattern here, was Esteban Ocon and Pierre Gasly in the two Alpines. And then Kevin Magnussen, K-Mag, rounding out the top 10 in last year's race for Haas. So, very interesting. Let's just take a little bit of a look here now at the track in Jeddah, the Jeddah Corniche Circuit. Obviously, it's only been open for a couple of years. We've had two previous races here. After the first race in December 2021, they made some alterations to the track just for safety reasons. That being said, the fastest time was set by Lewis Hamilton in 2021. It was a 130.734. This track is 6.17 kilometers long, or 3.84 miles, 27 turns, and we're going to get going here again this weekend. So let's take a quick look here. I've got the stats here. So Pirelli, they're bringing some of the harder tire compounds to this race. They're going to be bringing the C2 hard, C3 mediums, and the C4 softs. And just taking a look here, so this circuit is For abrasion, it's 2 out of 5 on Pirelli scale, meaning that, you know, tire deg shouldn't be as brutal as we saw in Bahrain last week. That is a very abrasive circuit, and tire degradation can certainly be an issue there, of course. So what are we going to see this weekend? 50 laps. And again, as I mentioned, Lewis Hamilton holds the lap record at 130.734. I'll take a look here, see if I have the fastest lap from last year pulled up. And I had it a moment ago. I'll take a real quick look here and see. No, I've lost it. Oh, no, I didn't. Actually, I have it right here. After all, fastest lap last year was a 131.906, and that was set by Max Verstappen on lap 50. So let's just take a quick look here. So there were a couple of things that's happened so far over the past couple of days in practice. So Lewis Hamilton was warned. Mercedes was fined for impeding in Saudi F1, in practice. So while on a hot lap through the circuit, Logan Sargeant had to take evasive action to avoid Lewis Hamilton, who was going fairly slowly through turn 10. Hamilton moved over to the racing line, and Sargeant had to turn somewhat violently to the right across the curbs, and said over the radio that that the near miss and colliding with Hamilton was what he called dangerous. So that's a bit of an understatement. After the practice session was over, both Lewis Hamilton and Logan Sargeant were called in to talk to the stewards. They handed out a warning to Lewis Hamilton and then a €15,000 fine to Mercedes for what they called a serious failure to keep Lewis informed of oncoming traffic. The stewards' verdict read as possible, or as following, quote, "The stewards heard from the driver of car 44, Lewis Hamilton, and the car 2 driver, Logan Sargeant, team representatives, and reviewed positioning, marshalling, system data, video, team radio, and in-car video evidence, and determined that car 44 impeded car 2 at turn 11. As a result, car 2 had to take evasive action by going off the track to avoid a collision. Had that not been done, there would have been a serious high-speed crash. Having listened to the team radio, it was clear to us that the team of car 44 failed to warn their driver that the fact that car 2 was arriving on a fast lap. This was a serious failure on the part of the team, particularly given the speeds on this circuit and the nature of turn 11, which is at the end of a series of high-speed corners where driver visibility is impaired. We therefore issue a warning to the driver and impose a €15,000 fine to the team," end quote. So not a good situation there, but fortunately the most important thing was the accident was avoided, and both Lewis Hamilton and Logan Sargeant are both okay. So Carlos Sainz, he's had a bit of a tough start to the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. He's had an illness that he's been struggling with for the last couple of days. He said after practice that it's been a very difficult 24 hours. Carlos had to say, quote, "Obviously a very difficult day after feeling sick. The last 24 hours have been tough and difficult for me. Today was all about trying to get myself on track and learn as much as possible from the car without really pushing too much the limits, as I was still a bit on the non-ideal side, but we managed to complete the program without issues. Hopefully tomorrow I'm feeling better, even if I'm probably not going to be 100%, but feeling better will allow me to be more on the limit and perform good on Saturday. And today it was very difficult to read into lap times. We will have to prepare everything and try to go for a good qualifying. This track is super high grip and high speed, so it makes it tough from a physical point of view. It's a lot more demanding for the car, but also for the driver. A tricky day, as I said, but we managed to get it done. Now we'll go and take some rest and come back to tomorrow stronger," end quote. So the fastest times that were set were Fernando Alonso and George Russell, and Max Verstappen, of course, is the favorite to win this event, which will I don't think it's going to be too much of a surprise for anyone. Anyways, I'm just going to take a real quick look here for Saudi Arabia. Let's see if we can pull up some practice times from practice 2. So Fernando Alonso set the fastest time in that session of a 128.827. George Russell about 0.2 of a second behind his fastest time in
in FP2 was a 129.057. Max Verstappen's fastest FP2 time was a 129.158. So a quarter of a second for Russell and 3.5 tenths of a second behind Alonso for Max Verstappen. Then rounding out the top 10 in FP2 was Charles Leclerc, Sergio Perez, Lance Stroll, Carlos Sainz, Lewis Hamilton, Pierre Gasly, and then Oscar Piastri in the McLaren. His fastest time in FP2 was 129.594, and that was 3/4 of a second behind the time of Fernando Alonso. Mercedes, they've gone with a very aggressive rear wing at the track this week. So they've a lot of the teams have arrived in Saudi Arabia with a lot of different upgrades and ideas to make their cars better and perform better on this very demanding circuit at Jeddah Corniche. So Mercedes have been fairly aggressive with its rear wing design. They've lifted and widened the flatter central portion of the main plane, and it's got a bit of a more abrupt transition into the end plate. So whether or not that will translate into some more speed, whether or not that means that that's going to bring them closer to Red Bull on Saturday evening. It's difficult sometimes to get all these time changes into straight in my head, considering that's a Saturday night in Jeddah and a Saturday morning here where I am. It's sometimes tricky. I'm used to Sunday evenings anyways, or Sunday mornings. I know I've lost complete track here. It's been a very, very long day. Anyways, quickly before I go, let's just take a real quick look at the 2024 Formula One Drivers' Championship and the Constructors' Championship. On the driver's side, after one race, we have Max Verstappen leading the way with 26 points. Sergio Perez, his Red Bull teammate, is second with 18. Carlos Sainz for Ferrari. Charles Leclerc, also from Ferrari. And then George Russell are third, fourth, and fifth currently in the Drivers' Championship. On the constructor side, Red Bull has 44 points, Ferrari has 27, Mercedes 16, McLaren has 12, and Aston Martin has 3 points. As I said, it's very early days with only one race under our belt, and we'll talk about it in a couple of days after the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix is over and see, can anybody close the gap? Will it still be Max winning this one? And that's going to be my default prediction until things turn around and he can be beaten on a consistent, regular basis. Anyways, I'm going to leave it right there. I hope you all enjoyed the show this evening. If you have a little bit of time, please head on over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and if you would leave a nice rating and review, that would be most appreciated, and that is the easiest and quickest way you can show support for the podcast. Head on over to X and give me a follow at Scuderia F1 Pod. If you want to get in touch, send me an email at scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com or slide into my DMs on X at Scuderia F1 Pod, or just tweet at me, X at me, post at me. I don't even know anymore. Anyways, stay in touch. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the race, and I'll be back on Saturday night to break it all down. Until then, have a great weekend, and I'll talk to you again soon. Bye for now.